This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brandi Zadrozny. You can usually find me at NBC News, where I'm a senior reporter covering the internet. For the next couple of weeks, I'll be sitting in for Brooke while she takes a well-earned vacation. This week, the House Select Committee hearings on the January 6th insurrection began, and for Capitol Hill police officers, an opportunity to give their perspective on the events of the day and the aftermath.
I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
For a moment in American history watched by so many, our memories and opinions of the day continue to defy consensus. Some of the violence, though, is beyond refute. During the attack, Daniel Hodges of the D.C. Metropolitan Police was forcibly jammed into a doorway by crowds of insurrectionists trying to get into the building. The footage is horrifying. Hodges took the stand on Tuesday, and he had one word to describe the people who stormed the U.S. Capitol, nearly taking his life.
I backtrack and started pulling the terrorists off my team. One of the terrorists who had scaled the scaffolding. Terrorists were breaking apart the metal fencing and bike racks.
When asked why he used the word terrorist, he replied with a definition from U.S. statute.
U.S. Code, Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 113, B as in Brown, Section 2331. The term domestic terrorism means activities that involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state, and B, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, or to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion.
After January 6th, demands to call the Capitol invaders domestic terrorists were everywhere. And the events of that day motivated a decree from the White House.
The Biden administration unveiling the first ever national strategy to combat domestic terrorism.
But not too long ago, that term was directly associated with its occupant.
The person who's behind all of the disinformation that's driving some of this domestic terrorism threat is the president of the United States.
The word terrorist packs an emotional punch. But it can also give some very practical powers to agencies that don't exactly have a track record of using them responsibly. For decades, the U.S. intelligence community has used extra-legal tactics to investigate, frame, and arrest people deemed existential threats to the government. In the 1950s, that meant socialist boogeymen.
New York and Pittsburgh, 17 U.S. communist leaders are arrested. Among them, Israel Amter, a charter member of the American body. Four more Red leaders are still being sought.
In the 1960s, the Black Panthers.
We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people.
Not many people know that the Panthers got some of their first weapons from a man named Richard Aoki. And nobody knew that Aoki was an informant for the FBI.
Where the state-labeled radicals go, the FBI follows, or infiltrates. And after 9/11, the scrutiny of the feds focused in on one particular kind of enemy of the state.
Breaking news tonight at 11. Police say they've found what appears to be an improvised explosive device in a car in Times Square.
It is unclear whether the suspect had help from others in planning the attack, but officials say it does appear he was at least inspired by terrorists.
Some of the splashiest stories around busts of terrorist plots, it turns out later, featured FBI informants as main characters. Like the 2009 story of four Muslim men arrested in connection with a plot to shoot down planes in Newburgh, New York. A plot they were led into by a man working for the FBI.
This operation was specifically designed to turn them into terrorists.
It's a tactic that, while fraught, hasn't gone out of style. Take the stymied attempt to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer, the purported warm-up act to the January 6th attack.
This is anti-American, this kind of language and threatening actions to our fellow Americans. This kind of behavior cannot stand, and people of goodwill need to call it out and call it domestic terrorism when it does happen.
At the time arrests were made in the case last October, it was a front-page win for the FBI, almost like something out of an action movie, complete with informants wearing wires, code names, and the rescue of a high-profile politician. Six men were charged in federal court with conspiring to kidnap a sitting governor, and eight additional men were charged in Michigan state court with providing material support for terrorist acts. But two investigative journalists at BuzzFeed News have now revealed that the story is much less clear-cut than federal prosecutors originally made it seem.
What we discovered speaking to defense attorneys, reading through extensive court documents, transcripts, was that the government didn't just have a passive role in this.
Ken Bessinger co-wrote the story for BuzzFeed News.
On the contrary, the government was very deeply involved in the entire situation almost from the beginning, had a network of multiple informants. We believe at least 12 informants working for the FBI were involved, as well as at least two undercover agents were mixed in with these people.
Can you tell me about Thor?
Thor is the code name the FBI gave to a guy whose name is Dan, and we know his last name, but we're not revealing it because he has expressed in court concerns about his safety. He is an Army veteran who served in Iraq doing the really toughest on-the-ground kind of combat you can imagine. Dan was a gun enthusiast and someone who wanted to keep his skills that he learned in the Army in shape, and he thought that he could potentially find individuals or groups in Michigan who he could train with. So in early March 2020, Dan went onto Facebook looking for people he could talk about the Second Amendment and guns with. The recommendation engine for Facebook spat out a few different things he could look at, and among them was a group called the Michigan Wolverine Watchmen.
And so Dan joins this group, and he's sort of concerned with what he sees after he gets sort of under the hood. He gets through the Facebook group. He goes on an encrypted messaging app, and something that he sees there scares him.
Yeah, that's right. When Dan, within a few hours of joining and looking through their encrypted messaging group, he finds messages that truly disturb him because instead of talking about training, they're talking about hunting down and killing police officers. One of the members encourages them to download a hunting app onto their cell phones that can be used to tabulate police officers' home addresses, and they could use that in theory to go and hunt them in their homes and kill them. Dan is scared enough by this that he goes and tells a friend who's a local police officer, and that friend communicates with the FBI about it. And within a few days, Dan finds himself inside the FBI's field office in Flint, Michigan.
And he becomes an informant, and he wears a wire. How else do Dan and the other, you said, dozen informants work with the FBI? And what does the FBI give in return for their service?
Dan's role with this group is to essentially let them mirror his phone and his computer. And he also, within about a month of signing up with the FBI, starts wearing a wire to pretty much every single event. And likewise, with other informants, we found that there's this large network of informants. We don't know the role of all of them. But for example, one of them is a gentleman from Wisconsin who, from the early stages, was planning meetings and organizing some of the meetings that the FBI and the Department of Justice have now pointed to as signal moments in putting this all together. And he went to great lengths to get people to come, and in some instances offered to pay for their lodging and transport if they would come to these meetings. So you're seeing financial assistance, essentially, from informants to get people active and involved. And in exchange, these informants were all reimbursed, not only for their expenses, but for more stuff. So in the case of Dan, who played such an important role in the case, he got $24,000 in payment for services from the government, an additional $30,000 for expenses. The government paid his mortgage for a while. They paid his telephone bill. They bought him a new computer, a new cell phone, and they bought him a new truck. And when he sold his house and he didn't get what he expected to get on it, they also paid him $4,500 to make up for the difference in the house price.
There's a conflict here, right, around the use of FBI informants. Some are going to say, whatever it was, these guys were in a car with night vision goggles plotting a kidnapping. And, you know, whatever you want to say about that confidential informant or no, it worked, right? There was no attack. But others are going to call that entrapment, or at least government overreach, saying that, you know, the men would have never been involved at all had the FBI not set the stage, picked the players, wrote a lot of the script.
Well, that's certainly one of the questions we were trying to poke at with the story. It reminds me of the old expression that you can't prove a negative. We, of course, will never know how far these men would have gotten without the government's involvement. The government can certainly trumpet the fact that no, the governor was never kidnapped, and that's true. But, you know, one has to wonder whether that surveillance operation would have ever happened without four or five government operatives in the cars that made that surveillance mission.
I have to say it's very reminiscent of some of the very popular far-right conspiracy theories we're hearing right now around the January 6th attacks.
The government knows who they are, but the government has not charged them. Why is that? You know why. They were almost certainly working for the FBI. So FBI operatives were organizing the attack on the Capitol.
Were you at all concerned in reporting your story that you could inflame those claims?
We were concerned we would inflame it. At the same time, we didn't feel, given what our reporting was, that it was appropriate not to talk about how this case was really made.
Your story specifically cites the court records that show the informants used by the FBI. And have you seen similar things inside the January 6th?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. We, you know, the government has even put one of its informants on the stand. So there was a full day of testimony by Dan, or Thor as he's known. And the government has also admitted it had multiple undercover federal agents. When it comes to January 6th, though, we haven't seen any of that, right? We've seen misinformed statements that court documents prove it, because they say they identify people as person one or person 12 in court documents, and they misunderstand sort of the rubric of federal courts where they think that means those people were undercover agents. But in fact, it's clear, if anyone understands how court documents are, those are not federal agents. And nowhere else has there been any kind of evidence that anyone was infiltrated in that crowd.
Can we talk about the term domestic terrorism? How did that label play into the FBI's operation?
You know, when the case was first charged, this was still in the Trump administration and Bill Barr was still attorney general. And they arrested these people and charged them in the federal case with one count, which was kidnapping conspiracy. And there was no mention of terrorism in the charging papers or in the press releases or any of the other documents. And then in April of this year, now under the Biden administration with Merrick Garland as attorney general, they added additional counts. And in the indictment, they specifically called the acts of domestic terrorism.
Are you suggesting that's political?
It's possible that might have been a reaction to the kind of pressures that the post-January 6th world has put upon the Justice Department to decide that this is domestic terrorism. You know, part of the context and backdrop is that there is no federal statute for domestic terrorism as its own kind of crime. There are definitions within different statutes that can be aggravating, that is to say they can increase the penalties when people are sentenced. That said, since January 6th, there's been a movement by some, particularly on the left, to create a federal statute that would officially make being members of a domestic terrorist group a crime and create a national list of domestic terrorism organizations. And that's a debate that's been going around in Washington. And you have some talking heads on this topic, ranging from former FBI agents to former prosecutors who have a varying degree of opinions about what the correct thing to do.
Yes, they're in my Twitter replies quite often. I'm sure that you've seen them as well.
I have, yeah.
With their calls to call it domestic terrorism.
Right. And, you know, I think it spotlights one of the things we really wanted to poke at with a story, which is, broadly speaking, people on the left right now want to see sort of everyone who's involved in alleged conspiracies to kidnap a governor or who walked into the Capitol to sort of be prosecuted to the full extent of the law and strung up in public if possible. And, you know, the right thinks it's overblown and government overreach and this is outrageous. And that kind of is an exact flipping of the script we might have seen in, you know, the 1960s and 70s with groups like the Black Panthers or the Weather Underground, or for that matter, you know, Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. So the worm has kind of turned completely around on that stuff. But I think, you know, a lot of civil libertarians, people who are interested in particularly the First Amendment, would say that the fundamental questions about government overreach apply to both groups, and that making these things into partisan issues distracts from the real questions that we as Americans should be thinking about.
So apart from Twitter reply guys and politicians, do you think that journalists have been using the term domestic terrorism responsibly?
I've seen instances where they haven't. I think there's a lot of pressure, and I think social media amplifies it, to be as sensationalistic as possible when covering these matters, right? People in your replies on Twitter who are like, call them a terrorist, call them a terrorist, call them what they are. Those of us who are here for the clicks and the likes, like, it's tempting to go down that road. But I don't think it really does a tremendous service to the public to just put that out there and not give it context. I think we have responsibility to provide as much context in the story as possible. And when we don't do that, we just feed stereotypes.
Ken, your original breaking story, the one 9 months ago, it was headlined, quote, "Here's how a group of radical militants hatched a plan to kidnap Michigan's governor before the election," unquote. Now, I have a confession, and it's that I wrote a story the same day, and I covered the story very similarly. Is it fair to say that your or our early coverage was too credulous?
I mean, you read that to me, and I'm just thinking I really should have thrown an allegedly in that headline. I'm not going to fall into the reporter's trap of just blaming editors for writing the headlines. I at least saw them, and I wish I'd thrown an allegedly in there, because it was a really big story, and we were all frantic to cover it, and we were receiving sort of direct into the vein what the federal prosecutors were telling us. And I tried, hopefully, to provide some analysis there, but ultimately, you know, we all in those moments sometimes serve as little more than transcription agencies for what the prosecutors want to put out there. And sometimes we don't want to hedge our writing by saying allegedly or what prosecutors claim and that sort of thing. But that language is really important, especially when we look back 9 months later at what we wrote. I think it's difficult because we as reporters want to feel the moment. And
it's intoxicating.
It is intoxicating. And I can't say I'm really proud. I think that story had a lot of good stuff about it. But I do think that we should have been a little bit more careful to cast that as allegations and not a definitive thing.
Knowing this lesson now, knowing that facts change, knowing that what we get originally is often right from the prosecutor and from social media, what should a news consumer keep, I guess, in their head next time they see a story like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a kind of a heavy burden to put on our readers to say, well, I'm circumspect and I should read a couple different sources on this. But in a sense, there is kind of a duty on readers to think that not everything that comes from the government is true and not everything from the press is true. And that's a weird conflict, because we, as journalists, try really hard to tell the things as true as we can. And we really get our backs up when people suggest that the lamestream media is making it all up. Because, you know, those of us who have worked in this for a long time know that we really do endeavor to do it, to play it as straight as we can and as honestly as we can. And that's a point of pride for us. But if readers can say, well, that's interesting, I can't wait to learn more, that might be a better thing than, okay, now I know that these guys were domestic terrorists, racists, who wanted to kill the governor. That's the kind of takeaway I wouldn't want to see happen.
Well, your story was really clarifying and I think made me think and will continue to. So thank you for writing it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. And thanks for the thoughtful questions.
Ken Bensinger with co-author Jessica Garrison wrote Watching the Watchmen for BuzzFeed News. Coming up, hacks, leaks, and data for sale. This is On the Media.